Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing money since 1937 with a focus on consistent results over the long term. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Did you happen to hear the president this morning?
We want to make sure everyone who's eligible for a check gets one.
He said those rebate checks are going to start going out on Monday. It's probably just a coincidence, then, that we also learned today consumers are more depressed than they've been since 1982. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the Society for Human Resource Management, HR, leading people, leading organizations, online at shrm.org. And by Clarkson Potters, The Splendid Table's How to Eat Supper, the cookbook inspired by the radio program for people who love to eat, available now.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you with us on this 25th of April. The economic indicator of the day on this Friday is the number 62.6. That's where the University of Michigan's Consumer Confidence Survey came in this morning, down from last month's measurement of almost 70. And it's the worst we've collectively felt about things since early in the first Reagan administration. Late in the second Bush administration, the president has decided to do something about that. Rebate checks are going to start being direct deposited on Monday.
This money's going to help Americans offset the high prices we're seeing at the gas pump and the grocery store. And it will also give our economy a boost to help us pull out of this economic slowdown.
The White House isn't the only place feeling the economic heat. With the summer driving season looming, congressional leaders are lining up to ease the pain at the pump, or at least look like they're trying. Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports.
Political prospects can rise and fall with the cost of a fill-up. Democrats who took control of Congress in 2006 know that, and that's one reason some Democrats want the Energy Department to stop stockpiling oil in the nation's petroleum reserve. But analysts say that will only make a small, temporary dent in prices. Other Democrats are asking the White House to cut off arms sales to oil-producing countries that refuse to boost output. Oil economist Philip Verleger says that strategy runs smack dab into the realities of the credit crunch.
The oil-producing countries will boost their output, but they can't find any buyers for their crude oil because the buyers can't get credit from the banks to buy more crude. There's both a cause and effect. If the oil-exporting countries produce more, it's not necessary that, there'd be buyers for it.
Democrats aren't the only ones with ideas for cushioning the shock of gas prices. Presidential candidate John McCain wants to temporarily suspend the 18-cent federal tax on a gallon of gasoline. The chief oil analyst at Platts, John Kingston, says that would offer some short-term relief, but sends the wrong signal to the oil market.
The last thing it needs is anything that's going to spur demand. Cutting federal taxes is going to spur demand. This is precisely the opposite direction we should be heading. And why you would be doing anything that would increase demand at a time of tightening supply is just beyond me.
Given global trends, most analysts say there's not much Congress can do to affect gasoline prices this summer, but that won't stop them from trying. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Microsoft CEO Steve Ballmer's got a big decision to make this weekend, exactly how hostile he wants his bid for Yahoo to be. Microsoft set tomorrow as a deadline for Yahoo to accept its $44 billion offer, or else. Or else what? Marketplace's Elisa Roth reports.
When Microsoft first offered $31 a share, Yahoo said no way, because it said it's worth more than that, even though the offer was more than 60% over Yahoo's share price at the time. Then, almost 3 weeks ago, Microsoft gave Yahoo an ultimatum. Take our money, on our terms, or we'll do this the hard way.
It's a deadline that was imposed by Steve Ballmer, so it means whatever Steve Ballmer wants it to mean.
Laura DiDio is an analyst with the Yankee Group. She says all this is part of the courtship ritual, including Microsoft's threat yesterday to walk away.
You've got Yahoo playing hard to get, and now Microsoft saying, okay, well, maybe we don't want you that much anyway.
Nobody really believes that. Microsoft made the offer because it needs help competing against Google. Steve Ballmer's already promised the next step will be a hostile takeover, likely in the form of a proxy fight to force the deal through. That could be expensive, and worse, it could send key Yahoo employees running, something Microsoft clearly wouldn't want. Matt Rozoff is an analyst with IT consultant Directions on Microsoft. He thinks there's another alternative. Microsoft could walk away temporarily.
See what happens to the Yahoo share price. Now maybe the stock will go back down again, then Microsoft will come back with a lower bid in a few months.
But he points out Microsoft has already said time is of the essence. If it's in a real hurry, it might just go through with that hostile takeover. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
Luxury brands usually don't suffer too much when the economy goes lowbrow. But this time, they seem to be heading in two different directions. Gucci is struggling. It's the first luxury company to make a big shift to cheaper down-market goods. Meanwhile, Louis Vuitton is growing like gangbusters. Our New York Bureau Chief Jill Barshay has more now on high-end retail.
Gucci may have become a victim of its own success. Milton Pedraza is the CEO of the Luxury Institute. He says Gucci's problem is when times were good, it expanded its customer base far beyond the millionaire set.
For Gucci, there's probably a larger proportion of merely wealthy consumers. And by that, I mean, let's say young women, professionals who make $150,000 a year but don't have a lot of net worth. And that group has cut back dramatically. And that's the group that, unfortunately, when you have economic recessions, trade down.
Gucci now plans to promote what it calls cheaper accessories. Instead of $3,000 leather bags, it'll push canvas totes for $900. Patricia Powell runs her own retail consulting firm, Powell Principal. She says luxury goods makers who've stuck with the ultra-rich are doing fine.
The market is going back to where true luxury goods were pre the 1990s, where the luxury goods were really for the top 1% of the U.S. population.
One example, LVMH, the Louis Vuitton group, is growing by double digits. It's buying Swiss watchmaker Hublot, which sells timepieces for as much as $475,000. Louis Vuitton also has the advantage of a strong foothold in the country that's minting millionaires faster than anywhere else, China. In New York, I'm Jill Barshay from Marketplace.
Down in Lower Manhattan today, it was a mixed bag. We'll have the details and the whole week on Wall Street when we do the numbers. Let me pick up on the theme John Dimsdale got us started with today, politicians and the lengths they'll go to when things get economically uncomfortable. The governor of Texas played to type today, perhaps with cause. Rick Perry asked the Bush administration for a break on ethanol. Specifically, he wants a partial waiver of the federal requirements for renewable fuels. Says they're hurting his state and contributing to the rise in global food prices. Joseph Rome's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. Mr. Rome, good to have you with us.
Great to be here.
Do you think Governor Perry just said today what's been on everybody's mind, that it's time to get out of this biofuels business?
Well, I think that we've gone too far on corn ethanol. I think we now can see the real impact it's having on food in the marketplace around the world and at home. And I think we need to rethink the corn ethanol policy, absolutely.
What should we do then? Is the answer to cut this mandate for renewable fuels?
Well, the mandate has two parts. It has a part for corn ethanol, and then it has a part for this other type of ethanol called cellulosic ethanol, which is a developing technology. And right now, we're probably around 7 or 8 billion gallons of corn ethanol capacity, which is getting to be like a quarter of the entire corn crop is going to make fuel. And the 2007 energy bill requires a doubling.
So we're not even where we ought to be yet, right?
Well, not under the law. So if you think, you know, the impact on corn and prices, and then indirectly, people plant more corn, they plant less soy and less wheat. So those prices go up, too. And as you say, we're about halfway to what the new law requires.
So what is the answer then?
I think that people have to ask themselves what they are interested in. I think it's a mistake to turn food into fuel. And I think if you were to talk to most of the scientific community today, they would agree with that assessment. What we need to do is move over to plants that can be grown on marginal lands or algae that don't require a lot of fresh water and don't require productive lands. That is the goal. And other alternative fuels. Biofuels are not the only possible alternative fuel. I mean, clearly, we need to get off of oil, though.
Do you think we should cut subsidies to farmers?
Well, if we're going to have the corn mandate, I mean, if you're going to mandate that that corn has to be grown and sold as ethanol, I don't. Then obviously you're going to drive up the price of corn, and I don't understand why you would also have subsidies on top of that mandate. I mean, you know, it's a mature industry. It's not like people don't know how to make corn ethanol.
In the final analysis, then, has the pursuit of ethanol done more harm than good, do you think?
I think the pursuit of the mandate for corn ethanol, especially in the 2007 energy bill, does more harm than good. I think mandating cellulosic ethanol that doesn't use a lot of energy, doesn't interfere with food production, and doesn't cause a lot of greenhouse gas emissions, I think that makes sense.
Joseph Rome at the Center for American Progress. Mr. Rome, thanks so much for your time.
My pleasure.
If you want to know more about what Mr. Rome has to say about alternative fuels and a whole bunch of other things, we've got some links on our website. It's marketplace.org. At this point in the recession, or slowdown, or whatever you want to call it, you're probably familiar with the term business cycle. Business and businesses have life cycles just like everything else. Demand creates new opportunities, and then when that demand dries up, businesses die. Every year, Fortune magazine releases a list of 10 businesses it thinks are facing extinction. Some of this year's casualties: record stores, crop dusting, and telemarketing. Oh, and gay bars, too. That one caught our eye because gay business in general is booming. Stacey Vanek Smith has more.
It's a busy weekend night at a gay bar in Los Angeles. Actor Jason Dotley says gay bars don't just cater to a gay clientele anymore. The scene has become a lot more mixed.
It's an indication of open-mindedness. I think it's a sign of progress.
But that progress has left some older gay bars sounding like this. The Boom Boom Room opened in Laguna Beach in 1947. It used to be a favorite hangout of Rock Hudson's, but today the windows of the white Art Deco facade are papered over. Fred Karger started coming here in 1973.
It's a magical place. It had a little kind of loungy bar. It had pool tables. They'd have this wonderful cabaret show on Wednesday nights.
The new owner plans to tear down the Boom Boom Room and build a luxury hotel. Gay bars all over the country have met similar fates. New York's Roxy, the Avalon in Boston, the Pendulum in San Francisco. But here's the weird thing. Gay business is booming. Gay spending power in the U.S. is worth an estimated $750 billion. So why are gay bars having so much trouble? Marketing expert Jerry McHugh says part of it is generational.
Generation X people and Generation Y people are less concerned about gay-exclusive socialization, and they're more interested in a more diverse environment.
McHugh says for gay boomers, bars used to function like community centers.
When I came out, it was early 90s, and it was really helpful to go to these places.
Boston Globe writer Robert David Sullivan says a few years ago, he noticed the number of gay bars in Boston had been cut in half. He says it was strange because they'd been such a cornerstone of the gay social scene.
It was sort of structured that you could meet people that way and you could say things and not censor yourself.
Sullivan says today, young gay men and women use the internet, not bars, to meet people. And the older generation has graduated from late night bar hopping to a mellow meal out. Of course, a lot of gay bars aren't disappearing. They're just becoming more mixed. Take the Abbey in West Hollywood. It's an institution on LA's gay scene, but on a weekday afternoon, there are as many straight neighborhood families as there are single gay men. Owner David Cooley says the gay bar business model worked 10 years ago, but not anymore.
If you would say to me, David, let's open up a gay bar, I wouldn't be investing.
Cooley is investing in gay-friendly bars. He's opening an Abbey in Chicago and plans to expand to other cities. He says all of the spots will be mixed. That's where the future is.
Once in a while, I'll get a customer say, the Abbey's becoming so straight. And my response is, isn't that what we've been working for all these years?
Bar owners George Butler and Randall Lambright disagree. They own the Savoy Orlando and Paradise Orlando in Florida. Butler says a mixed scene might work in places like New York and San Francisco, but in most of the country, the need for gay bars still exists.
I don't think we're quite at the point where the gay clientele is comfortable sitting in a chain restaurant or bar where they can still hold hands or kiss.
Co-owner Randall Lambright says many of the older gay bars have closed because they just don't meet the high standards of gay customers anymore.
I can remember when gay bars were basically back alley, dark, and not very inviting. And I think the clubs that are around are definitely more upscale.
Lambright says if the quality's there, the market for gay bars is still strong. He says the demand for exclusively gay spots hasn't gone away. It's just evolved. In Los Angeles, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Time to check the week on Wall Street. David Johnson is down in Dallas, Texas. Sir, how are you?
I'm pleased to be here. I've got people back returning my phone calls again, and we're beginning to see the all clear sign out there somewhere.
Are you really believing that, or are you just snowing me?
I hope so. My emotions have been on such a ride this week. Early in the week, I swear to you, I seriously thought about running out and buying one of those enormous bags of rice.
Yeah, right, exactly.
I don't know what I'm going to do with it, but everybody else seems to be doing it. And now, you know, by the end of the week, I'm really beginning to think that the battle cry that I'm beginning to hear around Wall Street is right. And the new battle cry, you know what the new battle cry is?
No.
One and done.
What does that mean?
Next week, the Federal Reserve Open Market Committee meets.
Yep.
They cut interest rates one more time, and then they're done.
All right, well, why, though? I mean, you know, everybody's saying, oh, yeah, Fed may pause, blah, blah. How come you believe that?
No, not pause. Done. Declare victory. This is the key. Let me give you this analogy.
All right.
Okay, so you want to buy a new flat-screen TV because everybody else is.
And in point of fact, I do, yes.
Okay, well, that used to be $10,000. And now you can get a dandy one for, $3,000.
Yeah.
Except that you get the new, you know, insert in the newspaper, and they're $2,500.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, if you're human, you don't go pay $2,500 because you know the next insert, they're going to be $2,100.
Right.
And you don't want to be an idiot and overpay. Well, it's kind of like this when you're cutting interest rates. You start this pattern of cutting interest rates. Well, the best thing that can happen is to ring a bell and say, okay, that's it. That's as low as they go. And now everybody rushes out and they start buying stuff and they start building stuff and they start borrowing money, which in turn sends a signal and the dollar gets stronger. And if the dollar gets stronger, then you understand the correlation with oil now.
Yeah, yeah.
So all of a sudden oil starts coming back down. Then the stock market gets healthy again, and then everybody returns my calls all the time.
Right. Okay. All right. So
no, but that's the pattern.
I got you. But here you go. Economics 101 through the eyes of David Johnson. Lovely. Except I'm going to go back to something, as I've done actually several times in the past couple of months, to something you said not too long ago, which is, do we know people are trusting each other yet?
No. Although they're, it's better. I mean, it's clear. It couldn't get any worse.
All right. Well, we're going to have
And I tell you, I'll remind you this again because I'm going to keep is what we talked about a month ago. And I'm telling you, the Fed walked in just at the right time and did just the right things to begin to free credit back up again. I mean, unfortunately, Bear Stearns was a casualty along the way. But in the long run, it may be a small price to pay.
That's why we talk to you every week, David, so that next Friday I can come to you and say, you know what? You blew it, big guy.
And you can hang me with my own words again.
David Johnson down in Dallas, Texas. Thank you, David.
Have a good weekend, Kai.
You too. Coming up, when being funny can make you money.
Where people have the chance to lighten up, to have a release valve, they appreciate that latitude that's extended to them, and they realize those are kind of fun perks that their neighbors don't have at their job.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials ticked up 0.3%, 42 points, to close at 12,891. The NASDAQ slipped 0.25%, 5 points, met the bell at 2422. The S&P 500 added 0.5%, 7 points, ended the day at 1396. For the week, the Dow inched up 0.3%. The NASDAQ moved 0.8% higher. The S&P 500 rose 0.5%. Yesterday's bleak earnings outlook dragged Microsoft down more than 6% today. The joyride for Ford Motor Company didn't last too long now, did it? Its shares spun out more than 10% after Merrill Lynch told investors to unload. General Motors sputtered down more than 3%. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.87%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by America's Family Physicians, offering patient-centered care so employees can better manage their health and employers better manage their costs. AAFP.org. Whether you're busy or lounging around, the economic gears are always turning. Marketplace is available around the clock, too, as a podcast. Get your financial fix whenever you want it. Download the show and take it with you. Just head over to our website at marketplace.org and click on podcasts.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at what's coming up Monday. In Washington, President Bush meets with the president of Guatemala. Amnesty International USA wraps up its annual general meeting in Arlington. And Tonight Show host Jay Leno celebrates his birthday. He'll be 58. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Most of the news you've probably seen about CBS lately has been about exactly that, CBS News and whether or not Katie Couric's going to be sticking around for too much longer. But there is plenty more for that company to worry about, the internet for one, advertising for another. Revenues are down in both television and radio. CBS Billboard, strangely enough, are doing fine. It is the company's fastest-growing division. Just this week, CBS spent $110 million to expand down in South America. From the Marketplace America's desk at WLRN in Miami, Dan Gratch reports.
Driving down the highway, you may have noticed one of those flashy digital billboards. They first started appearing in 2005, and they're the new face of outdoor advertising, the fastest-growing ad medium after the internet.
Out of home, which is considered the oldest media when you consider the hieroglyphics in the walls of the caves, is the hottest media right now.
That's Stephen Faso with Outdoor Services Incorporated. He says as people spend less time in their homes, advertisers have gone out and found them.
You have an opportunity to reach consumers throughout their daytime, at the gas station, in the grocery store, in their fitness center, in their local restaurant, in their bars and clubs. The list goes on and on and on.
While advertising in radio, TV, and newspapers tanks, outdoor advertising is growing by 7% a year. Unlike the old vinyl billboards that carried just one advertisement, digital billboards can rotate up to 8. That's why CBS, one of the biggest outdoor advertisers in the world, spent over $100 million for international outdoor advertising, which operates in South America. Lorraine Hadfield directs international audience measurement for Nielsen. She says the growth in outdoor advertising is driven by better billboards and longer commutes.
We use the term opportunity to see, and sometimes, you know, we could even use the term opportunity to mesmerize because you're literally sitting in gridlock.
Billboard viewership is also becoming a science. Nielsen now outfits people with GPS monitors to get exact measurements of how many people see a billboard. I'm Dan Gretsch for Marketplace.
How about this for a way to head off into the weekend? It seems backing off a little bit at the office can actually help the bottom line. Not slacking off, mind you, but just having a sense of humor. Adrian Gostick and Scott Christopher make that case in their new book, The Levity Effect, it's called. Guys, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Thanks, Kai.
Scott, you know, when you think of humor in the office, one of the things that people think about is Steve Carell from the television show The Office and how, try though he might, he just can't be funny. And here's what it sounds like.
Here's the thing. Whatever I write here has to be really, really funny because people out there are expecting it. I've already set the bar really high and they're all worried about their jobs. You know, it's kind of dark out there. Can you imagine if I wrote something like, Meredith, happy birthday. You're great. Love, Michael.
All right. So Scott, first question, does levity mean funny?
Absolutely not. I look at levity as kind of an umbrella term. It's not necessarily being a humor initiator or a humor generator, but quite often, especially for the vast majority of people who aren't born with a brilliant sense of humor, it's about being a humor enabler or even a humor tolerator. you know, just allowing it to happen, et cetera.
Yeah, that's the thing, right? There's the downside risk of trying to force it.
Exactly. Yeah, you come off as insincere. It feels disingenuine. It's like you're trying to push certain buttons that you simply don't possess.
All right. Well, Adrian, assuming you possess the buttons, what do you do to get this levity in the office?
Well, there's a lot of things that great companies do. We look to companies like, oh, KPMG, a big four accounting firm.
Just don't sound like a levity kind of place.
Exactly. You got auditors and accountants, and as they studied their workforce, they found that the number three thing that employees said, to get me engaged, you need to give me more fun at the workplace. And so they started doing fun things online, you know, pick the Oscar winners and download your favorite vacation photo.
Is it sort of the Silicon Valley thing where if you provide ping pong tables and scooters through the hallway, you'll get more productivity out of people?
There is, in fact, statistical correlations to support that, that where people have the chance to lighten up, to have a release valve, they appreciate that latitude that's extended to them, and they realize those are kind of fun perks that their neighbors don't have at their job, and so they're willing to actually work a little harder to keep that trust relationship there.
All right, so Adrian, let's say you get a job at, a public radio program, and you need to lighten things up and improve the atmosphere around here or, you know, well, somewhere. What do you do?
A couple of things. Start by being self-deprecating in your humor. Everybody loves to laugh at the boss, and if you're poking a little fun at yourself, it's a great place to begin this process.
Scott, which one of you guys is the funny one?
We're both funny in our own way, to be honest with you.
Come on.
No, it's true.
Answer the question.
No, really. Adrian has a really a tight, educated sense of humor. It's perhaps not as bombastic, but...
Scott's the funny one.
No, that's not true. I have not demonstrated one shred of funniness in this entire interview. Not at all. Nothing.
Clearly, you guys are making money at it anyway. Adrian Gostick and Scott Christopher are writers and consultants and who knows what else. Their book is called The Levity Effect, Why It Pays to Lighten Up. Guys, thanks a lot.
Thank you
so much, Kai.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a 529 plan can help meet your college savings goals. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note today to pick up where Texas Governor Rick Perry left off earlier in the broadcast. Worries over food prices have apparently brought about a tentative deal on the $280 billion farm bill. We told you about it yesterday. This afternoon, congressional negotiators announced they've come to a meeting of the minds. They're going to give nutrition programs an extra $800 million, that to help cope with the rising cost of food. Word is the money's going to come from farm subsidies, so it's probably safe to say the deal is not entirely done yet. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow shimmied up 42 points, a third of 1%. The NASDAQ fell 5 points, a quarter percent. The S&P 500 jumped 7 points. That's about a half percent there. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste West, and the executive producer of the program is J.J. Yor. Coming up on Monday, labor law fine print and your paycheck.
Every manager's job is to figure out how to get as few employees do the most work for as little money as possible. There's nothing evil about that. That's just how it works.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have yourself a great weekend.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.